Today's broadcast was originally recorded on February 20th, 2024.
Folks, it's a new day in Wisconsin. And today is a beautiful day for democracy.
I'll take it. It may be a rainy day in Southern California, but it's a beautiful day for democracy.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. Rochester, New York, WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV. Out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX. I think we got their weather. In Fairmont, West Virginia on WEFR. Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR. And Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet, rain or not. On the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com, now celebrating 20 years of troublemaking and muckraking. Thank you very much for joining us for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. We do have some very happy news for democracy today.
It's about time.
We'll take it when we can get it. That's out of Wisconsin. We'll get to that with my guest in a quick moment. But Desi Doyen, hello.
Hi.
Yet another atmospheric river drenching already saturated Southern California this week. So let's play our favorite game show. Climate change?
Of course.
Or not climate change?
Of course it's climate change, in part, because part of it is also the El Nino out in the Pacific, which is increasing temperatures of the ocean, which increases water evaporation, which increases moisture in the atmosphere. But on top of that, we've got man-made global warming, climate change, that is also doing the same thing, turbocharging the atmosphere, putting more moisture into it so that there is more moisture and rainfall to dump in California.
In Southern California, where it never rains, I hear, in Southern California. Funny that. Roads are now closed permanently in Malibu?
No. So the Pacific Coast Highway in Malibu, very famous scenic highway, is going to be closed at night indefinitely while crews try to repair erosion from high tides and from landslides and other erosion from the runoff from these storms.
We're keeping our eyes out for flooding out here. A lot of flood warnings over the next several days here, because again, the ground was so saturated from just a week or so ago, and now we're getting another one of these so-called Pineapple Expresses from Hawaii.
Yeah, from the Hawaii,
thanks, Hawaii.
Region of the Pacific Ocean. So, yeah.
Stay safe out there if you're in our Southern California listening area. But despite that rain, some very good news. For some 13 years now, since 2011, we have been reporting on this program and at bradblog.com on what Wisconsin Republicans did after taking control of the state. The state assembly, the state senate, after the 2010 election and the 2010 census, when they drew up new gerrymandered district maps to assure a Republican majority in both chambers of the state legislature and in their U.S. House delegation. With control of the state legislature and a far-right Republican, Scott Walker, in the governor's mansion, they became arguably the most radical legislative body in the nation, comfortable, of course, in the knowledge that thanks to extreme partisan gerrymandering, they could not be removed from majority control, no matter how the bulk of the state would vote, no matter how unpopular their policies were statewide. It was the opposite of representative democracy. But it was, as I feared and as I warned at the time, a laboratory for Republican control in the rest of the nation. What happened in the Badger State over the next decade, just as I had feared, became the model for far-right legislative thuggery, the type that we have seen take hold in state after state since then, and now at the congressional level. No matter how large the number of voters, votes that Democrats received statewide in Wisconsin, Republicans would stay in control of both chambers of the state legislature, with near supermajorities in each chamber. That, thanks to those gerrymandered maps that, though challenged in court, they were allowed to hold for more than a decade. With help from a corrupted Republican state Supreme Court at the time and from the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court, the GOP held firm control of the state legislature for more than a decade, despite Democrats winning 14 of the 17 statewide elections during that period. And of the state's 8 congressional seats, Democrats currently hold just 2, despite most statewide offices, including the governor's office, held by Democrats in the closely fought presidential battleground state. But as of Monday, I'm happy to say, at least in the state legislature, that undemocracy will finally be coming to an end, at least in theory. As Wisconsin's tireless Democratic Party chair Ben Wickler wrote on Twitter on Monday, "The long dark night of ultra-partisan gerrymandering is over, and a new day for democracy now dawns in the Badger State. The stroke of Governor Evers' pen today marks the end of a shameful period that began in 2011 when Republican lawmakers, bound in secrecy by non-disclosure agreements as they worked with operatives at a lobbying firm, drew legislative lines that guaranteed that even landslide election losses wouldn't cost them their majorities. The result was one of the most egregious, extreme partisan gerrymanders in American political history," writes Wickler. "Ever since, Republican politicians in Wisconsin have used their power to take more power away from the people of our state, restricting access to the ballot, removing authorities that voters had entrusted to statewide elected officials like the governor and the attorney general, and smashing the freedoms of workers to organize and advocate for themselves. For 13 years, the democracy-proof legislature has been laying siege to democracy itself," writes Wickler. Last April, he continues, "years of tireless organizing culminated with Wisconsinites electing Justice Janet Protasiewicz to the state Supreme Court in a landslide, charting a new course for our state that has led to the new, vastly fairer maps that were signed into law by Governor Evers on Monday. In November, at long last, Wisconsin voters will have a real choice in who represents them in Madison. The majority will determine the majority," writes Wickler. In fact, on Monday, Wisconsin's Democratic Governor Tony Evers signed new legislative district maps for both the state assembly and the Senate into law, maps that he proposed and that the Republicans who control the legislature passed to avoid having the liberal-controlled state Supreme Court draw the lines. Said Evers prior to the legislation,
"These maps reflect the will of the people. Wisconsin, when I promised I wanted fair maps, not maps that are better for one party or the other, including my own, I damn well meant it. Wisconsin is not a red state. It is not a blue state. Wisconsin is a purple state, and I believe our map should reflect that basic fact."
In fact, Democrats in the state legislature actually voted against Evers' maps. It was Republicans, ironically enough, who voted in favor of them, even as Democrats are almost certain to gain seats in both state chambers under the new maps, which will be in place finally for this November's elections. Senate Democratic leader Dianne Hesselbein said in a statement that the new maps are, quote, a huge win for the people of Wisconsin, even though she voted against the maps. So Democrats in the state legislature support the map that they voted against, and Republicans are opposed to the maps that they used their gerrymandered majorities to adopt last week. What exactly is going on here? Well, in the 13 years since we have been covering this bastardization of small d Democratic values and seeing it spread to much of the rest of the nation like a poison, we have touched base with our old friend in Madison, Wisconsin, for the inside skinny of what it all means. Many of those conversations were grim. Today's, perhaps, much less so. Joining us now is that old friend, journalist John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation, contributing writer for The Progressive, and associate editor of his local Madison, Wisconsin Capital Times, where he remains a favorite progressive son. He's also the author and co-author of more books on progressive politics than we can mention here, though we will mention his latest, titled It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism, which he co-authored with some guy named Senator Bernie Sanders. John Nichols, welcome back to the broadcast for some happy news, I think, on Wisconsin gerrymandering.
Absolutely, Brad. It's happy news. And I got to tell you, I have talked to you in all sorts of settings over a very long time. I don't know that I've ever heard you so enthusiastic. And frankly, you are sounding, because you've been so involved with the Wisconsin fight for so long, you are sounding like a lot of Wisconsonites.
Well,
today,
you know,
I was, yeah.
It's democracy. I mean, it's not, you know, a policy win. It's not even a political win. It's democracy itself winning. Now, John, I know this is, I know it's good news, if only from Ben Wickler's, frankly, moving post on Twitter on Monday. But Democrats voted against these maps for the state, Senate, and Assembly in the legislature, while Republicans voted for them before the Democratic governor, Evers, who actually drew them up, signed them into law. All of that is pretty confusing for someone who is not from the Badger State. Can you explain the basic politics of what went on in that vote?
Absolutely. Here's the deal. The governor drew his maps back, you know, they're based on maps drawn a couple years ago.
Uh-huh.
And the thing that he was trying to do a couple years ago was to negotiate with the Republicans who had total control of the legislature. And he was basically saying, as a good government guy, which he really is, he's like old school good government.
Mm-hmm.
He's basically saying, hey, we have divided governance. Why don't we come up with a compromise, mm-hmm. one that really would allow Republicans to win if they get the most votes, allow Democrats to win if they get the most votes, you know, basically a decent set of maps, but not a particularly good set of maps for Democrats. In fact, a set of maps where Democrats have a little hill to climb, mm-hmm. in order to win. And at the time, that seemed fine, right? You know, that was good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the intervening reality, though, is that in successive Supreme Court elections in 2020 and then again in 2023, Democrats took total control, or progressives, it's an independent Supreme Court, but mm-hmm. progressives took total control of the Supreme Court. And the four justices on the Supreme Court who are progressive are unbound, right? They're not politicians. They are, you know, pretty serious analysts of the situation. And the situation was that Democrats and Republicans felt that if the four justices drew a map, right, mm-hmm. if they ordered a map, it would probably be very good for the Democrats,
mm-hmm.
i.e. that the Democrats might actually, instead of having a hill to climb, be for the first time in a very long time in a situation where they had the advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Republicans tried everything. They threatened to impeach,
right,
one of the Supreme Court justices.
Yeah.
They tried to pass alternative maps. They tried all sorts of stunts. The Supreme Court is now, like, literally on the cusp of coming down with its maps, or was on the cusp of coming down with its maps. And in that rock and a hard place situation, the very wily Speaker of the State Assembly, Robin Boss, a very conservative Republican, decided he had no options. And so he passed the governor's old maps, right?
Because
basically,
they were the best that he was going to get, at
right.
It seemed like.
And he was able to go to his caucus,
yeah,
and say, look, we might lose power on these maps, but we might not. Mm-hmm. Whereas something we get from the Supreme Court, we almost certainly will lose power. And so he got them all united, and they passed it. But the Democrats in the legislature were saying, hold it, we'd much rather let the Supreme Court do its work and uh-huh. give us what they get.
I can't. By the way, if you say I'm about the happiest you have ever heard me, John Nichols, you're about the happiest I have ever heard you. I just want to underscore that point. Now, so Democrats voted against this because they thought they might get a better deal from the Supreme Court. But also, yep. there are questions about when this map actually goes into effect. Does it go into effect only for the November elections, because there might be, including a recall of Speaker Voss, there might be some special elections between now and November, no?
Of course, and that's a really big deal. And in fact, the paper I've long been associated with, the Capital Times in mm-hmm. Madison, editorialized in favor of letting the Supreme Court do its business, right? Mm-hmm. Not having the governor and the legislature do these maps. Not because the governor's maps are bad. They're actually, you know, they're good, solid, small d democracy maps, but because there was a problem with how the Republicans in the state Senate and the state assembly passed the maps. They passed them to go into effect in November. Now, the problem is that Wisconsin usually has two or three special elections every year, mm-hmm. and we're pretty good about them. We get them scheduled fast and we hold them fast. And so it is within the realm of possibility, not a certainty, mm-hmm. that you could end up with a couple special elections that, especially in the assembly, not just Robin Voss, but for other seats, mm-hmm. that would create a situation where the Republicans under the old maps could theoretically have gotten a veto-proof control of the state assembly. Huh. If they did, then they could have come back. They could still theoretically come back and pass a whole bunch of things. And the governor could veto him and they could override him, uh-huh. right?
Yeah.
Because the split in the assembly is so close, man. On that.
Yeah.
And so that was, we're getting real technical, mm-hmm. but that's one of the reasons why a lot of good government Democrats were like, I don't trust Voss on this one.
Now, Evers,
there's one other.
Evers says that he believes these maps take effect immediately and that is not a concern. Is he wrong about that?
He might be wrong.
I see.
But that's the other problem I was going to tell you about, Brad. And again, not to rain on the parade too much, but the fear, and this is going to be a fear at least through the start of April, for another month and a half, is that somebody might file a lawsuit and say these maps don't work in this way or that way. Mm-hmm. They maybe might be a lawsuit based on, you know, some quality of the lines, might be a lawsuit based on some of the other issues that you're just bringing up, whatever. Bottom line is that if this gets into the federal courts and you get a conservative judge, mm-hmm. what you could end up with, and this is the fear, is that you get a judge who simply says, that's a legitimate case. I'm going to sit on this for a while, and we'll run the 2024 elections under the old maps.
And that brings us to what we're probably going to see in a lot of these cases, because there are a bunch of challenges around the country to various new legislative maps, the so-called Purcell principle, which the Supreme Court invokes when they want to put something off. They say, well, it's too close to an election to make a decision.
Right.
We're going to keep the status quo. We'll figure it out later. That is a concern.
Before
we get to that, though, let me just sort of underscore what happened in Wisconsin. Republican State Senator Van Wangard said in a statement following the vote approving these maps last week, quote, Republicans were not stuck between a rock and a hard place. It was a matter of choosing to be stabbed, shot, poisoned, or led to the guillotine. We chose to be stabbed so we can live to fight another day. Now, John Nichols sounds kind of drama queeny to me, but after the the state Supreme Court ordered these new maps to be drawn up, For their consideration, they asked for maps from Republicans and Democrats in the legislature, as well as the governor, as well as independent folks. The high court found the Republican maps to be just gerrymanders once again, that they wouldn't even consider. And Republicans have said that every map that they did not draw was actually a Democratic gerrymander. Just to put a period at the end of that, are the maps that they finally settled on actually Democratic gerrymanders, as the Republicans are claiming?
Definitely not. In fact, look, the map that has been drawn is, if you went to like a government class and you said, okay, give me a map, you know, in a complex, very divided state that would probably give you a decent reflection of where the people are at, right? That's this map. It's what it means is this: if it's a good year for the Republicans, it's very likely the Republicans are going to control the legislature. If it's a good year for the Democrats, there's a decent chance the Democrats control the legislature. If it's a very, very close year, and remember, in Wisconsin, of the last six presidential elections, four have been decided by under 25,000 votes, right? So it's a closely divided state. In a so closely divided state, there is probably about, you know, this is marginal, but a marginal lean toward the Republicans. Well, so these are not gerrymandered Democratic maps at all.
And I just wanted to sort of get that on record, because I know that I know what the Republicans are going to do. We've seen them do it. You know, no matter what it is, they're going to claim they're be, you know, they're the victims here of the out of control liberal court or whatever. So I just kind of wanted to point out that, no, this is not a Democratic gerrymander, and it could go to Republicans, both chambers this November. Now, John,
easily,
as a Wisconsin native and a political journalist, let's assume, since we're in a good mood today, let's assume that things go well, as you or I might hope, and these new maps may change things finally in the state after the November elections. What do you expect the makeup of the Senate and Assembly could actually be? But more importantly, what specific policies are expected to change going into this new era in a sort of a best case scenario this fall?
So the Senate's easier to flip than the Assembly. It's fewer seats and they're bigger districts. And so if the pattern is good for the Democrats, you're more likely to have a Democratic majority there. The Assembly's a little bit harder. And so you could end up very possibly with a split, right, where the Republicans have one chamber, Democrats have the other, and they have the governorship. In that split, you're going to have negotiations. But it's probably doable to get something out of that, and you can govern, but you're going to be governing on, you know, cobbling together a budget, and then you give somebody a bridge someplace, and so they vote for the budget, and you know what I mean? It's a, it's the old kind of narrow margin of victory type situation. If Democrats take both chambers and you have the governor, well, I'll give you a very good example. You and I started talking a lot about Wisconsin back in 2011 when we were having the fight over Act 10, which was Scott Walker's anti-labor takedown of public employee unions, literally the law that made it virtually impossible for public employee unions to organize and collectively bargain. You could come in the first day with that new legislature, hold a hearing in the morning, and get rid of Act 10 in the afternoon.
Oh, don't see now you're just getting me too excited, John.
Yeah, I know. But that's entirely because remember, that's what the Republicans did on the other side.
Yeah, they did.
And here's the interesting dynamic of it. The only reason the Republicans succeeded in gutting out labor law in Wisconsin, even they did it without following the rules in the legislature and it went to the courts. But they had a conservative Supreme Court that backed them up in their illicit governing. That won't happen now because the Supreme Court is a progressive Supreme Court. So you end up in a situation where if the Democrats take both chambers of the legislature, they will be able to, in, you know, in a matter of weeks, reverse the labor law changes. They will also, they could, in a matter of days, and I think this might even be the first thing they did, if the court doesn't do it already, and the court may actually end up doing this before, they can get rid of our 1849 anti-abortion law, which is on the books still and is a problematic factor in the state. You know, it's kind of endless, my friend.
It's
crazy. You just run the list.
Democracy.
Well, every disappointment, every disappointment the Democrats have had over the last 12, 13 years could be undone.
Of course, that'll never happen. We'll go back to our grim conversation soon. But for today, John, the reason that, that the the new state legislative maps were redrawn is because the liberal court that you mentioned, now a 4-3 court, determined that the current maps were in violation of the state constitution because the districts were not contiguous. In other words, pieces of one district were in the middle of another. Now, following that ruling that those were unconstitutional, the court was asked by Democrats to review a challenge to the state's congressional district lines for the U.S. House under that same premise. Now, the Republicans currently hold 6 of 8 U.S. House seats in Wisconsin, an otherwise evenly divided state, as you note. What is the status of that suit, that challenge? And might we see a decision in time for the 2024 elections as well there?
Great question. The Supreme Court has not taken that case yet. It is on the, you know, it's in the hopper. It's in the offering. Mm-hmm. Now that the legislative district issue is out of the way, everybody is kind of sitting on, you know, like tender hooks, right? It's bated breath. Mm-hmm. Will the court take it? If the court takes it, then, you know, it's the majority is there for to draw better districts. The districts are incredibly unfair. They're actually more gerrymandered than the legislative districts, right? Mm-hmm. Because the legislative gerrymander created a 2/3 Republican majority mm-hmm. in the chambers. You've got a 3/4
yep.
Republican majority in the congressional delegation. Right. So the argument is strong. And I think the question is, it's going to be a practical question. Does the court grab them in this very narrow window,
right.
appoint experts to analyze, draw up new maps, or at least suggest new maps? They're going to have to let people propose things. It'd have to move very, very quickly because you got to get this done theoretically by April 1st, roughly.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Is there time in the best case scenario? There still is time?
Yes, of course there's time. Yes.
Okay.
Because the court took the legislative maps basically around New Year's, mm-hmm. and we're still relatively, midway into February, and this thing has been resolved. We've got about that much time again before the filing process begins for congressional districts. So, yes, and then there's one other prospect here that the court could simply move the filing deadline. They could, draw the new districts in order, say, yeah, we need 2 more weeks. Mm-hmm. And that would certainly be functional and doable.
When are the primaries scheduled for Wisconsin for U.S. House districts?
Mid-August.
Mid-August. Okay, so there is time. John.
Yeah, but it is getting close.
Yeah, it is getting tight. Normally, state party chairs, John, are sort of nameless bureaucrats who few in the state in question would even be able to identify. But Wisconsin's Democratic Party chair Ben Wickler has taken on sort of a national presence. He's being hailed from many quarters today after he's led this fight for the party for so many years. How important was he to all of this, and what kind of credit does Ben Wickler deserve for what has happened here?
Yeah, I talked to Ben I talked to Ben a lot, mm-hmm. and he's the funny thing about Ben is he's always in the fight, and so. He's not the kind of guy who is walking around saying, look what I did, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. He's fretting about Wisconsin for November, right? But because he's always in the fight and because he redefined what the fight was, mm-hmm. he basically gets a huge portion of the credit here. Now, I would give the most credit to grassroots activists who've been organizing on these maps issues for decades, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And literally did it at the county level. They got counties to pass referendums. They got county boards to, there's a lot of kind of infrastructure of activism underneath this.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Ben Wickler who, more than anyone else, identified the 2023 Supreme Court race coming right off the 2022 elections, mm-hmm. basically said, this Supreme Court race is going to decide it all, mm-hmm. right? It's going to decide whether we get fair maps. Mm-hmm. And that brought huge amounts of, I hate to say it, but it's the reality of politics, huge amounts of money mm-hmm. in, energized, turned that Supreme Court race into something very close to like a gubernatorial election, even a presidential election. It was such a big deal.
Yep.
And won big. And since Ben came in to Wisconsin and took over the chairmanship, the party has essentially won virtually, not all, but virtually all of their major races. Mm-hmm. And so with the Supreme Court flip, that's the key to this whole thing. So you want to give somebody credit. I think Ben Wickler gets, you know, a huge portion of the credit. And it isn't just him personally. It is it's a mentality that he brought to the state. And that is that Wisconsin progressives got down pretty far. They were beaten down to a point where there really was a discussion about, is Wisconsin going to go the way of Iowa or Indiana?
No.
States that were once pretty Democratic, but are now, you know, or even Ohio, right? States that have become pretty solidly Republican. And it seemed for a time that that was where it was going to go. And the mentality shift, right? The sense of, no, that doesn't have to happen. Wisconsin can actually be what it was historically, a progressive kind of icon, you know, a North Star. And it ought to be that. And that, I think, re-energized the people at the kitchen tables, you know, the grassroots activists, the Democrats across the state in rural areas as well as urban and suburban. Ben Wickler tells a story. I did a big profile of him for The Nation. He tells a story about when he went around, when he was running for chairman, he went to all the counties around the state and sat at, you know, in the winter, this election was held like in midwinter in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And so he's in all these places. He's sitting at the kitchen table with people, and they're basically saying, you know, we don't want to give up. We want to fight, but it's got to be a fight because we're so far down. If this isn't the fight of the century, we're not going to make it. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, yeah, I want to do that fight. That's why they elected him as a very young guy as their chairman. And it worked. You know, look, that's, bottom line is it worked.
It worked. John, before I let you go, I noted that, and you know, by the way, the idea that Wisconsin, the birthplace of labor unions, could ever go the way of, what'd you say, Indiana or Idaho?
Ohio.
Iowa, right. I'm glad that doesn't seem to be where it's headed, but litigation does continue in more than a dozen states, as I mentioned, over House and legislative districts in other states that were enacted after 2020. What should the rest of the country, John Nichols, take from what we have seen play out in Wisconsin over the past decade?
Well, it's a very simple lesson. Don't give up. No matter how far down you are, no matter how much of a climb you've got, you know, just decide on one day you're going to take hold of your destiny and that this is the day the future begins and you start building back, right? And that's what happened in Wisconsin. It took a long time. It would have been very easy to give up, but the decision was made not to give up and to keep on fighting because you might get to this day. And the other thing I would say is, as much as I am a Wisconsinophile, right, and somebody who's always going to say Wisconsin's the greatest state in the country, blah, 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 I will tell you, look to Michigan, because Wisconsin is still in process, right? Wisconsin is still struggling to get there. Mm-hmm. Michigan got there. Mm. They got independent redistricting, which drew fair maps after the 2018 election. In 2022, they had fair maps, finally, after a long process. They elected a Democratic state assembly. They elected a Democratic state senate. And I was in Michigan last Tuesday as the laws officially went on the books, eliminating their anti-labor right to work law, expanding collective bargaining rights for teachers and for graduate students. Restoring all sorts of wage protections for construction workers. Michigan has now gone from a year ago, just a couple years ago, being one of the more anti-labor states in the northern part of the country to having probably the best labor laws or very close to the best labor laws in the country. That's what you get when you don't give up. You get to actually transform it.
Yep, that's don't give up. That phrase has come up a lot this week. Also quoting Alexei Navalny, don't give up. Good advice.
Yes.
John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation, associate editor over at Madison's Capital Times, also author of It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism, which he wrote with Senator Bernie Sanders. You can follow John's work, of course, on the site still known as Twitters, at Nichols Uprising, and of course, thenation.com and everywhere else. John Nichols, great speaking with you. I don't know what's going to happen if they approve the new U.S. House maps. John, we're just going to run out of things to talk about, apparently, because we will have solved everything. But thank
you. If they approve the new House maps,
yeah,
Wisconsin will lead the nation to a Democratic majority in the House.
That'll give us something to talk about. Thanks, John. Hope to talk to you soon.
Thanks, brother.
You bet. Okay, we really are going to run out of things to talk with John about if things keep going well.
Yeah, but wow, that is such great news out of Wisconsin. And one of the things that really jumped out at me was, first of all, he said, this is what you get when you don't give up.
There you go.
And then also, he pointed to county-level grassroots activists who he said were integral to this victory by working at the local level and then working their way up the ladder. So yay for the activists.
Yay. Don't give up, which is a great place to take a break here and come back with some more news along those lines. Also, Green News Report a little bit later this hour. I'm Brad Friedman, and you're listening to the Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to do it. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate to make an automated monthly pledge of any amount you like, or even just a one-time only contribution to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. The fight for voting rights, civil rights, and to save our planet continues. Please help us continue that fight independently over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate right now. Go ahead, do it right now. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
Don't give up on us, baby. We're still
well done. Well done, Desi Doyen. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, speaking of not giving up, don't give up. And speaking of Michigan, since John Nichols mentioned them as the sort of the model these days for what democracy can look like, even in states that have been, you know, seemingly overtaken by corrupt Republicans in recent years, willing to do anything to hold on to power. Well, anything other, I guess, than actually offering popular legislative policies.
Oh pshaw. Who would do that?
I know. Well, the Supreme Court on Tuesday rejected an appeal from Sidney Powell and several other lawyers allied with former President Donald Trump over $150,000 that they were slapped with in sanctions, ordered to pay for abusing the court system with a sham lawsuit challenging the 2020 election results in Michigan. The justices did not comment when they left in place the sanctions against seven lawyers who were part of the phony so-called Kraken lawsuit. Remember that?
Oh, yes.
Filed on behalf of Republican voters after Joe Biden had defeated Trump in Michigan by more than 150,000 votes. Among the lawyers in the group is also L. Lynn Wood, whose name was on the lawsuit. A bunch of Team Trumpers initially met at his estate following the 2020 election to plot the various ways they hope to steal the election from Biden. The group included, among others, Sidney Powell, a guy named Doug Logan, who's the one who led the now defunct and discredited so-called cyber ninjas. Yes, he was there from day one. They did the sham post-election audit in Maricopa County, Arizona. It was Doug Logan who spent days in the Coffee County, Georgia election office rifling through the state's statewide voting system software unlawfully. So L. Lynn Wood has insisted, however, that he played no role in the Michigan suit other than to tell Powell that he'd be available to help if she needed a litigator. Nonetheless, his name was not dropped from this. The money is owed to the state and to Detroit in order to repay their costs in defending the bogus lawsuit, which the court found to have been so evidence-free that it was found to be an abuse of the legal system itself. Thus, the sanctions against the attorneys, the Trump attorneys. It was initially $175,000. A federal appeals court reduced it by about $25,000, so $150,000. But the attorneys were willing to take their case all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, where they have now finally lost again.
Good.
In October, Powell, a former federal prosecutor herself, pleaded guilty to state criminal charges down in Georgia over her efforts to steal the election for Trump there as she organized the Coffee County voting software breach you've heard us mention once or twice on this show. She was originally charged with 7 felony counts in that case, including conspiracy to commit election fraud and conspiracy to commit computer trespass, before she agreed to cooperate with prosecutors who allowed her then to plead guilty to instead to 6 misdemeanor counts related to conspiring to intentionally interfere with the performance of election duties. She gained notoriety, of course, for saying in November 2020 that she would, quote, release the Kraken, invoking the mythical sea creature when talking about a lawsuit that she was planning to file to challenge the results of the presidential election that was going to take them all down. It ended up taking her down instead. That would be the presidential election that Joe Biden won and Donald Trump humiliatingly lost. So justice does come, continue to come for all of the Trump liars and thieves. It just takes a while. Justice takes a while. And as we saw in Wisconsin, so does democracy. But as John said, as did the late Russian dissident and fierce Putin opponent, Alexei Navalny, don't give up. There has been a bunch of polls in recent months suggesting that Republican support for Donald Trump in 2024 is going to collapse if and when he's actually convicted in one of the 4 criminal felony cases that he's currently facing in 4 different jurisdictions. I've mentioned that I'm somewhat dubious about that, that, you know, even if he's convicted, his propaganda machine and his sort of direct connection to the very brains of his brainwashed cult followers would likely, you know, be able to make the case that his conviction, even in a criminal case, was itself a miscarriage of justice, and that he might be able to turn that somehow into a positive for him rather than the negative that many currently seem to think that a conviction of felony crimes would be for this guy and would be for pretty much anyone else in the world. It's not only Trump himself, but our country, which is dangerously ill right now in so many ways. But to sort of buttress my case on this, take a look at how his supporters have responded to last Friday's verdict in his New York civil fraud trial, in which he and his company and his 2 eldest sons, Don Jr. and Eric, were ordered to pay nearly $400 million for their decades-long fraud spree in New York, and they were barred, Trump was barred from doing any kind of business in New York for 3 years. Eric and Don Jr. barred for 2 years for this fraud in inflating their net worth to get favorable rates on bank loans and to deflate their assets to get lower rates on taxes and insurance. That case took about 5 years since New York began investigating it in order to reach the crushing defeat in court for Donald Trump last week. But of course, his supporters since then have come up with all sorts of reasons why Trump wasn't really guilty of defrauding all sorts of people, and instead it was he who was the victim in a conspiracy led somehow by Joe Biden, who has absolutely nothing to do with New York state charges, much less state charges that began before Biden was even the Democratic Party's presidential nominee back in 2019. But now, you know, Trump supporters are claiming after Trump told them to make these claims, that there was, this is an outrageous miscarriage of justice. It's against Trump by partisan prosecutors, because there's never been a case where, you know, there were no victims. So before we get to our latest Green News report, allow me to share you a short bedtime story from Jack E. Smith. He's a popular Jack Smith parody account on Twitter by someone who I think is a lawyer, but I don't know for sure. Anyway, it goes like this. A bedtime story for your kids and MAGA relatives. Once upon a time, there were two businessmen, Don and Bob. Both had roughly the same amount of stuff. They both wanted loans to get more stuff and grow their businesses. Bob went to the bank for a loan. He told them how much stuff he had. The bank said they couldn't loan Bob all the money that he wanted because he didn't have enough stuff as collateral. Bob was sad and had to give up his dream of growing his business. Don, on the other hand, went to the bank and exaggerated how much stuff he had. By a lot. For the record, the New York Attorney General, by the way, argued successfully in court that Don had exaggerated by more than his net worth by more than $2 billion a year over the past 11 years that were included in this trial. Back to the story. Don was a slick talker and had false paperwork to show that he had a lot more stuff than he really did. The bank felt more comfortable giving Don the loan because they believed he had enough stuff to offer as collateral. Don ended up getting more stuff and living large. Who is the victim? Not the bank. One could argue they should have done their homework on slick-talking Don. But it's Bob. It's the thousands of Bobs who follow the rules and do not lie and cheat their way into a better life. Who protects people like Bob? Who makes sure the rules are fair for all? The Southern District of New Effing York. That's who. The end. Now, I will say that actually New York Superior Court Judge Arthur Engoron, in his ruling on Friday, actually disagrees with Jack E. Smith's bedtime story here somewhat, in that he did find that the banks actually were victims, that they should have made $138 million more than they did on their loans to Trump because their rate was lower based on Donald Trump's lies about his collateral, about how much his assets were worth. And so he got lower rates than he probably should have received based on his false claims, such as his Trump Tower apartment being 30,000 square feet. Instead of the 11,000 square feet that it actually was. I guess it's the bank's fault that they didn't go up to the apartment with a tape measure and actually measure it out to find out what size it was. But of course, that allowed Trump to inflate the market worth of that apartment by tens of millions of dollars. In fact, an expert who testified for the prosecution during the trial actually estimated that Deutsche Bank lost $168 million in extra interest on its Trump loans, not the $138 that the judge decided they lost. So Judge Engoron actually let Trump off easier on that score. Nonetheless, in fact, yes, there are a lot of victims here, including you and me and everyone else in the marketplace, which has been bastardized by Trump's lies. Nonetheless, his supporters have been told that this is an outrage, an injustice. There was nobody defrauded here. The banks were all very happy. Everyone was happy. He repaid the loan. Why should there be any problems just because he lied and bastardized the actual market? But my point for now, and I do have one, is that even if Trump, even if he ever gets to a criminal trial this year, don't put all of your eggs in the basket that, you know, once he is found guilty, if he is found guilty, that somehow his support is suddenly going to drop out because these MAGA Republicans who have been with him for this whole ride are suddenly going to realize, hey, this guy's a crook. I mean, that might happen, but frankly, you would be foolish to count on that. Instead, for those who want to see Trump defeated this year and hopefully American democracy saved in the bargain, well, you better put in the work to make that happen. Because it is most likely going to happen or not, not in the courtroom, but at the ballot box on November 5th this year. No matter what happens in all of the many court cases and legal filings to come in the days ahead. So, if you care about democracy, my advice is the same as John Nichols, is the same as Alexei Navalny's. Don't give up. Green News Report is straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman, and you're listening to the Bradcast.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast. Hey, Desi Doyen, we had a lot of pretty good news today on the show.
Yes.
So now we come to your portion of today's program.
Yes, which is a little less positive.
You're going to ruin it for us again, aren't you?
Yes, it's what I do.
Here comes Desi bunking our high in the latest Green News Report.
This past summer, the Florida Keys saw its most intense and relentless marine heat wave ever.
Record heat wave decimated Florida's coral reefs. The plastics industry knew for 50 years that recycling didn't work and deceived the public about it. Plus,
22% of species listed by the UN's Convention on Migratory Species are at risk of extinction.
Nearly half the world's migratory species are in decline, UN study finds.
All of those cheerful stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
My friend Jimmy bought an electric car. He's very excited about it. Then he bought an electric blanket. Then he bought an electric guitar. Then he bought an electric chair, and I haven't heard from him.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, here we go again out here in Southern California with another atmospheric river just deluging us out here for the next 3 days or so.
Yep, nearly the entire state is under flash flood alerts, and so it's a good time to ask if your community is upgrading its infrastructure for extreme weather.
I doubt it. What else you got for us today?
Sad news, unfortunately, for Florida's coral reefs. A new survey of 5 reefs in the Florida Keys shows extensive damage from a severe, long-lasting marine heat wave last year when water temperatures topped 90 degrees Fahrenheit. The prolonged heat killed more than 3/4 of human-cultivated coral that scientists had transplanted in the Keys to boost the coral's chance of survival. The NOAA researchers also found widespread death among wild coral. Scientists blamed human-caused global warming and the intense El Nino weather pattern in the Pacific for making the water too hot for coral, which is also affecting related species like plankton.
I was going to say, what happens when the coral dies?
It destabilizes marine ecosystems, and it's doing it around the world, and that has dangerous implications for the ocean food web. Ocean heat globally hit a new all-time record high late last week, breaking high temperature records set just last summer. Again, due to man-made global warming boosted by El Nino. Current global sea surface temperatures are more in line with June, and that has hurricane forecasters very worried because ocean heat provides fuel for hurricanes later this summer.
In the middle of February, we have heat as if the ocean was thinking it's June?
Yes.
That's not good.
In other news, nearly half the world's migratory species are in decline. That's according to a groundbreaking new report from the United Nations. And worse, more than 22% of species currently listed as threatened on the UN's Convention on Migratory Species are now at risk of extinction. The biggest threats to migratory species are overexploitation and habitat destruction by humans, pollution, invasive species, and climate change.
Humans.
Some good-ish news. The U.S. is on track for its warmest winter on record, and those mild temperatures have slashed demand for natural gas. The Financial Times reports natural gas prices have plummeted by more than 50% since mid-January, just as production has surged to record levels. Less burning of natural gas means less emissions, less air pollution, and, side bonus, helps accelerate the demise of coal.
I'll take it.
Meanwhile, President Biden traveled to East Palestine, Ohio late last week to mark the one-year anniversary of the chemical train derailment that caused a massive environmental disaster. Biden detailed the administration's ongoing efforts to help the community recover, saying federal agencies will remain on site as long as it takes. Biden called on Congress to finally pass long-awaited rail safety reform legislation, and he placed the blame squarely on the train company, Norfolk Southern.
Well, there are acts of God. This was an act of greed that was 100% preventable. You know, multi-million-dollar railroad companies transporting toxic chemicals have a responsibility to do it safely. And again, Norfolk Southern failed.
And speaking of greed, Norfolk Southern's derailed train was carrying flammable toxic vinyl chloride, a key ingredient in plastics manufacturing. Now, a new blockbuster report from the Center for Climate Integrity has uncovered internal documents revealing how the oil and plastic industries knew more than 50 years ago that plastic recycling was not technically or economically viable at scale. The report shows how the industries launched a misleading public campaign over decades using deception to falsely promote plastic recycling as a solution, profiting from fueling the world's gargantuan plastic pollution crisis, all while forcing the cost burden of plastic waste onto consumers and communities.
It's almost as if the industry has more say to our politicians than the consumers do.
Mm-hmm.
Weird. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Follow where the money goes. Mm-hmm. Follow where the money goes. Follow where
yep.
the money goes.
I know it don't go to us. Anyway, thanks very much, Desi Doyen, our producer. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you kind enough to help the money go in our direction via bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, you will find me at The Brad Blog, and you will find Desi at Green News Report.
Yes, come by and visit.
Please do. Say hello to her. Leave me alone. That's it. We will see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Follow where the money goes.